Very pleased to have with us here on the phone lines here a new author here, an excellent book. We want to thank his people for having sent us a copy of this. In 50 years, we'll all be chicks and other complaints from an angry middle-aged white guy, as I hold this up to our stunning new HD cameras here in the studio here at the network. This gentleman is a longtime comedian, talk show host, media personality, et cetera, et cetera. His career continues to take on new forms all the time here, really, and he's really made a big splash himself in new media in the last 2 years. I'm speaking, of course, of Adam Carolla. Adam, welcome to the FDH Lounge. Good to have you in tonight. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm just assembling my son's castle while we speak. Otherwise, they'll start yelling at me.
Well,
these kids, they got so much junk this year.
Now, how challenging is that? I mean, given your background in carpentry here, you know, you get something like that. Do you look at something like that and you think that's a breeze, or is this thing pretty tough?
Well, I'll tell you the problem after spending an hour trying to put together a Hot Wheels set that didn't quite go together as planned yesterday. The thing that's weird is I'm a builder and have built many custom houses and have done a lot of wrenching on cars and done a lot of things that were would be considered pretty advanced in the building department. But what I don't have is patience and the ability to read instructions. And these things now all come with 10,000 little pieces. Like, it's insane how many little bits of plastic are around my house. And it's just one more thing to step on barefoot at night, of course. But so the answer is technically I should be good. It's sort of like when you see you ever see those, like, sports shows where they take some great decathlete or some great soccer player, basketball player, and you have them try to hit a softball and they can't do it?
it's the craziest
thing. Like, if you watch George St. Pierre, you know, the ultimate fighter, and you see the guy pick up a softball bat and he swings it like my daughter and you can't get it out of the infield, and you're like, God, you're such a honed athlete. I could hit the ball 200 feet further than that drunk if I switch hit. How is it that such a great athlete? That's what it is with me in these castles and these Hot Wheels. How can such a great builder not be able to put together a crappy plastic castle? But sure enough, I'm flailing.
Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive, you know, the way that goes. But, those instructions and all the little pieces, parts and stuff, yeah, I don't envy you trying to assemble that sucker. Was very interesting. I mean, in terms of your building background and everything like that, I learned an awful lot about everything with you from reading the book. I wasn't really aware of your background earlier in life, and particularly growing up and some of the poverty and everything like that. It really kind of struck me as being interesting because you've lived in the same geographic area all your life. You know, we hear about people going out to SoCal, you know, and they make it in the entertainment industry and they seek out the bright lights. But you're a guy that's lived there his whole life, you know, and you a lot of times probably drive the same streets that you drove, you know, earlier in your life. What must seem almost like another life altogether to you in some ways. I mean, is it 15 plus years later, is it something that you've really kind of come to grips with? You know, the fact that it's been sort of like two different lives out there as far as levels of success and everything else, or over a period of time, is it something that just kind of seems more natural to you?
Well, it is weird, and yeah, like you said, and I've thought about it and talked about it a time or two. If you're Tom Arnold, not that he's the benchmark of success, but Tom Arnold, nice guy, good friend, and he worked at like the Hormel, you know, pork processing factory in Iowa, right? And that guy has, I'm sure some bad memories of canning some hams back in the day. But he doesn't have to pass the factory on the way to his Hollywood job. That's back in Iowa. And I have this weird thing, and I don't know if it's good or it's bad, but I oftentimes have to drive through my old neighborhood, drive past my old house, my old school, my friends. I mean, it's sort of surreal. And every once in a while, I'll do it just for fun. And every once in a while, I'll turn right instead of left just to circle back and take a look at the old apartment I was living in when I was 19 and stuff like that. But I had this crazy thing where I was dropping my kids off at their preschool, which is back in my old neighborhood, about 2-3 miles from where I live now. And as I was dropping them off, I had to park down the street. And it's one of these preschools that's just sort of in a residential home, basically. And I'm walking down the street, and I'm like, oh, yeah, there's where there's where my friends lived, and also it's weird too because I'm passing a house where two out of the three brothers were there were three brothers and two out of three of them were dead before they were 25. I think the third one's still alive, and you remember playing with them as kids, and then all you know one gets AIDS and the other dies a drunk driver and blah blah blah, and it's like it's sort of surreal. But here's the crazy part is I'm walking my kids down the street by 8:30 in the morning. I smell cigarette smoke coming from what seems to be the school, and I thought, I know none of these parents are out front smoke. I'd be happy if one of the parents were out front blowing a butt, but I know it can't be any of these people. These are super Hollywood types. They would never allow it, so on and so forth. And I come walking down the street, and there's a guy, there's like an Israeli guy smoking a cigarette in his mid-30s, and, you know, he's got the members-only jacket and the hair coming out of the chest and everything, and he's standing out there smoking. And I look at him, and I'm walking past him, and I hear him go, hey, Adam! And I say, hey, how you doing? Because, you know, I get the man show stuff every once in a while, and he goes, hey, it's Rivi! And I was like, huh? Rivi and Ronnie! The two Israeli kids I used to babysit, Rivi and Ronnie, you know, when I was 11, I babysat them when they were 6 and 7 years old, except for now they're 40, and they're chain-smoking, and they have chest hair, and they're driving a Corvette. And it's the craziest thing where you wouldn't see it anywhere else, where you're just walking your kids into school and there's Rivi smoking a cigarette, sitting leaning up against his Corvette with his gold chain on, and he's a 41-year-old dude who I used to babysit.
Yeah, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, it would seem odd if it didn't seem a little bit surreal to you. Yeah, I mean, being in the same area your whole life and just having, you know, this vast kind of spectrum of experiences.
Well, not only did I, you know, live in a 1,000 crappy apartments all in the same basic area and rent 100 crappy houses, but you got to remember, I built a lot of houses and a lot of, condos and apartments and custom houses and commercial stuff. So everywhere I drive around the city, I'll pass the, you know, Pier 1 Imports I built on Wilshire Boulevard in 1988, and sometimes I'll just park my car and just stare at it for a while. it's kind of fun, but again, surreal, yeah.
Probably not a lot of other folks in the entertainment business in Hollywood that have stories like that to tell. There was something else that struck me from your book, too, with your observations about assumptions that are made vis-a-vis your politics and how you tend to get put on the right an awful lot. It kind of got the sense from looking at this. First of all, I kind of come from the assumption that people probably, you know, would have the same qualities regardless of what time they were born in. So I have the sense that probably if you were around 40, 50 years ago, I mean, you might be shaped a little bit by the times, but, you know, your act probably would be largely the same. It seems to me if you were around at the time of Lenny Bruce, maybe the opposite assumptions would have been made. That was sort of before political correctness and some of the things with speech codes, and you can't say this to offend that group. It seems to me that assumptions that are made about you, you know, are probably more a product about the day and age that we live in. What are your thoughts about, these assumptions and how they've kind of, you know, grown over time?
Well, you know, it's funny because you know yourself and you know what's in your heart and how you feel toward people and topics and in your family and friends and all that kind of stuff. So it's always, you know, it's that same feeling where, you know, when you have a colleague or a coworker, and then, you know, you find out 5 years later when they're drunk at the Christmas party, they're like, oh, man, I was really intimidated the first year I was working around you. Like, what? What do you care? What, me? Why? Why are you intimidated? Well, I was just nervous to be around. You know, you almost can't feel it. You can't picture it. You're like, why would you be nervous around me? Why would you? And I can never really internalize it, you know. Like, you know, the whole time we did the Man Show or Crank Anchors, I was the boss. But I never felt like the boss when I walked into the building. But I do realize other people felt that way, you know. It never felt that way to me. I just thought I was working there with everyone else. And so there's the way you feel and then the way people think of you or feel about you. And those can be two terribly different things. And I also realize that people don't have enough time to get to know anyone in this sort of fast-moving society we're living in. Like, you have your assumptions about Lindsay Lohan, and I'm sure the half of them are true, but I'm also sure if you got to know her, you'd probably know a completely different person. You don't have time, in other words, and rightfully so. I'm not saying you should educate yourself on Lindsay Lohan. I'm just saying, we all have our feelings about this person, that person. It's like every homeless guy you see pass in the street. I'm sure there's a story there. We're just never going to hear it. All we know is there's some bum. He's on our lawn, and okay, I'll finish the castle in a second. All I know is this guy needs to clear off our lawn.
Yeah.
And he just go, come on, Wino, have another beer. Get out of here. Who knows what this guy's story was and is. And I understand, you know, people hear me railing about something, they hear it secondhand, or they hear about the Man Show, or they read a couple excerpts from the book, or they hear about it, and they just go, all right, here's the guy he is. I don't have time to investigate. Normally, and happily, when people do take the time to investigate, they'll find out that, you know, I have varied opinions on the right and the left, and I'm pretty fair-minded about stuff and, you know, don't have a evil or deceitful bone in my body.
Well, there are some opinions that I know that you have, you know, a little bit of a lighter note here. Some of the culinary stuff in the book really cracked me up. I'd like to get your thoughts on this, on what your reaction would have been. There was something I had happen to me over the holidays. I was visiting my brother's family. I see this nice tin of what appears to be holiday cookies, and I'm salivating. It's looking good. I cracked this sucker open, and one of their neighbors or friends or whatever had made, like, their own homemade Chex Mix. It wasn't even good enough, apparently, just to go buy a bag or whatever. Like, they assembled it themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what would your thoughts, like, how violent would you get if you saw something like that happen? You were all geeked up for something like that. I know your feelings on some of these mixed things here from the book. I can't imagine you'd be too thrilled by that.
I don't like when people burn calories screwing up things that weren't broken, you know, like, you know, making your own Chex Mix, I probably wouldn't get violent. I will get violent when I find out that somebody has taken, you know, they take the stuffing that you normally have in the turkey, but they put golden raisins and currants and, you know, sprig of mint in it, and it's like it wasn't broken. Don't try to fix it. It was fine the way it was. I mean, I feel this way with goat cheese. I don't need it spread all over everything that used to be good. I don't need it in the salad. I don't need it on the pizza. I don't need it mixed in with the stuffing. I don't personally like goat cheese, but the point is who said stuffing wasn't working the way it was made by Mrs. Cubison in, you know, 1907. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you can work on food that's broken, but last time I checked, pizza was not in need of a repair. Nobody ate a meatball and onion pizza and announced, well, that's it. Enough with the pizza. Someone's got to put some poached salmon on this baby, otherwise I'm not coming back to it. Like, everyone loves pizza, and it's not broken. Let's not try to fix it. It's an L.A. thing, by the way, to try to do a turn on The one thing that wasn't, I don't think, in the book, which should have been, is everyone doing their own version of what we traditionally know. Like the last, like I went to the W Hotel in Phoenix and was sitting by the pool and ordered a club sandwich and got like basically a big roll with some turkey and some ham, some Swiss on it, but it wasn't toasted and it wasn't three levels and it didn't have bacon on it. It was their club sandwich. And I feel like they need to tell you there's no picture of it on the menu. So, in other words, like, if you go to the W Hotel in Phoenix and order a club sandwich, you're not getting a club sandwich as you know it. And if you go to the Hard Rock Hotel Casino in Vegas, down at the diner down there, and you order Huevos Rancheros, you will get a breakfast burrito. And there's nothing wrong with a breakfast burrito, except for I didn't order a breakfast burrito. I ordered Huevos Rancheros, and then they do that move where they go, yeah, this is how we do it. Well, here's the deal then, sweetie. You got to give me a heads up when I order it, because this is, I mean, I could order an orange juice, and you could give me a goblet filled with seagull crap and go, yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah.
That's what we do, but that's not helping me. I'm hoping the whole reason we have titles for things, the whole mommy's not here and daddy's ranting. The whole reason we have titles is so that you can identify things, so that you know what a club sandwich is and so that you know what Huevos Rancheros is. If you guys just all set off on your own course, then you're going to screw up the whole thing, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, they need to, you know, drop an asterisk on that sumbitch or let you know in some way. You know, it's full disclosure.
Let the chick who's taking the order, when you go, I'll have an order of Huevos Rancheros, she needs to go, I hope you're not expecting Huevos Rancheros.
Yeah.
Because what we do is we take a bunch of scrambled eggs and we put it, and we basically give you a breakfast burrito. This is not Huevos Rancheros. We call it that. And by the way, you who ordered a club sandwich at the W Hotel in Phoenix, do not expect a club sandwich to be brought back to this table.
Right.
It's going to be two pieces of bread. It's not going to be thin. It's not going to be toasted. It's not going to have bacon. It will not resemble. It'll essentially be a ham and Swiss on a Kaiser roll, but we'll call it a club sandwich.
Yeah.
It should be legal, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, disclosure, transparency on the menus. Yeah, that is not too much to ask for. But, Adam, to bring it full circle here from your book to your other primary project of the moment here, the podcast that you're doing, I find it to be very interesting, you know, as you know, dealing in new media myself with everything that you've got going on. Talk about that and the success that you've had to getting it to be the number one show on iTunes, how you kind of segued into that, you know, unintentionally, it seems like, you know, the terrestrial thing came to a close. You started kind of experimenting with it. It turned out to be there. But, I mean, obviously, you know, you're finding some of the challenges with monetization of it and making it a viable long-term project. Talk about all the things that have gone on since you started up your show.
Sure. My radio, terrestrial radio career ended in February, I guess, of 2009. And I had the rest of the year. I got paid out. I got paid until the end of the year. So I bought myself about 10 months to sort of experiment. And my buddy Donnie said, you should do a podcast. And I said, how's that go? I didn't know what that was. And he said, you know, you say whatever you want, you record it, you put it out there. And I said, yeah, why not? Because to me, it was always just about taking my ideas and putting it in people's head, you know. And, you know, people ask, well, you know, you wrote a book and you did a movie and you do the radio and television and stuff like that. So what do you like the best? And I don't like any of them the best. So all I want to do is take my idea or thought or beef or gripe or whatever you want to call it, and I want to insert it into your skull. It doesn't, I can be in the same room with you, or we can do it over the phone, or I can do it via the written page. It doesn't really matter. You can come to a live show. It doesn't matter. I'm only interested in putting my ideas into your head. That's all I care about. So it doesn't really matter how I do it. And the podcast seemed like a pretty efficient way to deposit my ideas into other people's heads. And if you're like me, and you like the sound of your own voice, and you can wax on about most things for longer than you should, and you don't need to take a break every 6 minutes for commercials and stuff like that, it seemed like a pretty good media choice for me. So we just started doing it, and it just sort of, you know, got some momentum and some popularity, and it got a couple of good notices and reviews and write-ups and things like that. And as far as the challenge of monetizing the podcast, it's pretty straightforward stuff. You have X amount of ears on your product, and, you know, if you had a bullhorn that reached a couple hundred thousand people, then you could get some money to do a commercial with your bullhorn, you know. And if you had one, you know, it doesn't really matter whether it's a dirigible or a TV show or terrestrial radio or internet podcasting. It doesn't really make a difference. It's just, do you have an audience or don't you have an audience? And then if you tell that audience, hey, man, go to ProFlowers, will they do it or won't they do it? And the thing about the computer, which is a little different than terrestrial radio, is you can find out pretty quick if you can get your audience to go swing by ProFlowers and check them out or not. And there, we happen to have a nice, motivated group of people who listen to the show, and thus we get results for our sponsors, and thus we have plenty of sponsors now. So it hasn't been as difficult as people think, and there's not much to it or as much to it as people assume. It's go out, get an audience, and start charging sponsors to mention their product on your show, and it's the same as terrestrial radio, or it's just same as TV. I mean, it's just sort of old as time, or at least old as radio.
Makes perfect sense when you explain it, Adam. You know, I mean, the basics are the same regardless of what medium you're on. Last question I've got for you. You've mentioned a couple times here tonight, you know, people mentioning the Man Show to you. You'd mentioned it in the book also. I mean, obviously, you know, you get that a lot from people, but I can say, as somebody who's done some broadcasting myself and who's on kind of a variety type of a show here, that it's sort of had a little bit of influence on stuff that we've done. We don't necessarily delve as much into the, you know, heavy mail-oriented stuff, but, I mean, I'd be lying if I didn't say it was an influence, and I suspect that that's the case for a lot of other shows, too. You know, is that something that that you get a lot from people who've done broadcasting, who've said that, you know, what you guys did kind of opened up my eyes a little bit to the potential of that kind of broadcasting and to trying to reach guys with that type of humor and that type of ability to hit topics that we're all thinking about?
It'd be nice if they did, but no, they don't. I think everyone gets influenced by anything they like, whatever you're into, music or jokes, sports, communicating, broadcasting. You know, it's funny because even though it wasn't that long ago, it was a different time. There wasn't, at the time we started doing the Man Show, there wasn't really anything like it out there. And, you know, it originally was a pilot that we were going to try to get on to ABC. And they're, you know, of course, because they're who they are, they're like, where's the female perspective on this thing? Like, they wanted to do the Man Show, except for they wanted to be, you know, half Man Show stuff and then half chick stuff. Like, we had to offer up equal airtime to the female point of view, which now looking back on it seems insane. And by the way, this is why executives, especially television executives, will screw up everything they touch. Like, you know, way back in, you know, 97 or something, you know, Jimmy and I are saying, we got to do a show, and it's the man show, and it's all about guy stuff, and it's for men, and it's by men, and we, and, you know, and of course, then there's a long pause, and they go, all right, but obviously we need a female voice in the show, so how are we going to capture that? And we're like, no, no, we don't have a female voice in the show. That's the whole point. It's a man show. It's for men. Okay, but where does the female voice come in? Like you guys don't get it, right? Like, they will dilute anything and screw up anything they can get near, which is a lesson to young folks who are looking into getting into the business. We happen to have escaped them, you know, and ended up on Comedy Central and had a little more leeway with them. But it is weird when you're doing stuff that doesn't exist. You know, now everyone would understand that concept. I mean, there's a whole, you know, there's Spike TV. You know, Spike right. TV didn't even, there was nothing. I mean, the notion of having a network for dudes would have been heresy when we started the Man Show. And as a matter of fact, when we, you know, about 2 years into the Man Show, Jimmy and I always talked about it. Like, just going, there should just be a network for dudes, you know. And I'm glad people saw it, and I'm glad, you know, they responded to it, and, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. So, but no, we do not often get called pioneers, if that's what you're asking.
Oh, okay. No, as far as it being influential, yeah, I mean, I think you make a good point. I think that's why me and some other people regard it that way. As you say, as recently as the late 90s, it really, when you guys came on with it, it was a different landscape. And as far as what you said about TV execs, in many cases, being pinheads, perfect example of that. You actually got name-checked in this once or twice. I just got done reading that great new Bill Carter book. Of course, your friend Jimmy Kimmel appears in there quite a bit. The whole thing about Conan and Letterman and Jay from the last year. Boy, if that doesn't encapsulate the potential of TV execs just to be complete and utter idiots, you know, I guess nothing does.
It's there are some of the least funny people you'll ever meet. That's number one. Number two, they, in an attempt to be all things to all people, are nothing to nobody or nothing to everyone. It's almost like if these guys opened a restaurant, I mean, anyone who's in the restaurant business understands, look, serve good Italian food. And it's like, yeah, well, how do we make sure we're keep our lights on and keep our doors open and stay flush and busy, then make great Italian food or make great Mexican food or make great Thai food and you will be busy. But what you don't do is go, look, how do we attract the people with an appetite for Mexican food, Thai food, Japanese food, Chinese food, ribs, barbecue, and Italian? And it's like, you don't. If you try to do that, if you try to make a restaurant that serves great Italian food and great Thai food, you're going to screw it. You're going to have bad Italian food, bad Thai food, and no restaurant. So just focus, pick a path, stay on that path, and focus on it. But they won't do that. They have to be all things to everyone, and it never works out. That's why all those this is why all those sitcoms are so milquetoast and comatose and everything with a toast at the end of it. It's like they, oh, it's got to have heart and everyone's got to be likable. I mean, you have no idea. I've been through that process. How many times they go, oh, he's got to be likable. Everyone's got to be likable. This guy doesn't seem likable. It's like, was Archie Bunker likable? You can't get comedy out of likable. It's hard to be. It's hard to get comedy out of likable.
Right.
None of those, you know, Fred Sanford, none of those guys were likable. George, what the hell is Bunker?
Jefferson.
Bunker. Yeah, well, he wasn't like none of those guys. They were beyond. They were unlikable. That's what made them funny.
Well, even the guy on, and I don't get to see it that much, but what's that? The one nerd show, the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, Big Bang. Theory.
That guy's not likable.
Yeah, well, that's why the show worked, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you can't make everyone... You make a sitcom now, they want to make everyone likable, and it's the least funny option there is.
Well, you know, you're preaching to the choir, Adam. We're pretty fanatical on this show about the whole be yourself kind of a thing. So agree completely with you on that. Of course, again, the book is In 50 Years We'll All Be Chicks and Other Complaints from an Angry Middle-Aged White Guy. As I hold this up to our HD cameras one more time here. Adam, it was a lot of fun having you on here tonight talking about your various projects. You're welcome back anytime to talk about them. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Rick. It was my pleasure. Anytime you like.
Thank you so much, Adam. Appreciate it. Adam Carolla, everybody. Talk show host, comedian, multimedia performer. So he's an actor. There are many things that you can add to that as well. Awful lot of fun talking to him.